Narayana Namaskritya Naram Chaiva Narottama Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jaya Mudirayat. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our very means of conquest, I first of all offer my obeisances unto the personality of Godhead, Narayan, unto Narayan Rishi, the supermost human being, unto Mother Sarasvati, the goddess of learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author. I offer up also to Srila Prabhupada, who made these Srimad Bhagavatam accessible to all of us. Nashta praeshu abhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavatir tamashloke bhaktir bhavati nashtaki. By regular attendance in classes on the Bhagavatam and by rendering service unto the pure devotee, all that is troublesome within the heart is almost completely destroyed, and loving service under the personality of Godhead, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4. Chapter 28, which is entitled Paranjana Becomes a Woman in the Next Life. And today we'll do text 13. Yavano Parudayatano.
Yavano Parudayatano.
Yavano Parudayatano.
Yavano Parudayatano.
Grastayam Kalakanyaya. Grastayam kalakanyaya.
Grastayam kalakanyaya.
Puryam prajvarasam shrishta.
Puryam prajvarasam shrishta.
Puryam prajvarasam shrishta.
Puryam prajvarasam shrishta.
Purapalon vatapyata.
Purapalon vatapyata.
Purapalon vatapyata. Yavano Parudhayatano.
Yavano Parudhayatano.
Grastayam Kalakanyaya.
Grastayam Kalakanyaya.
Puryam Prajvarasam Shrishta.
Puryam Prajvarasam Shrishta.
Purapalon Vatapyata.
Purapalon Vatapyata.
Prabhus.
Oh.
Yavana,
Yavana,
by the Yavanas,
by the Yavanas.
Uparudha,
Uparudha,
attacked.
Attacked.
Ayatanaha,
Ayatanaha,
his abode.
His abode.
Brastayam,
Brastayam,
when seized. Kalakanyaya,
Kalakanyaya,
by the daughter of time.
By the daughter of time.
Uryam,
Uryam,
the city.
Prajvarasam
Srishtaha,
Prajvarasam Srishtaha,
being approached by Prajvara.
Being approached by Prajvara.
Hurapalaha,
Hurapalaha,
the city superintendent.
City
superintendent. Anvatapyata,
Anvatapyata,
became also very much aggrieved.
Became also very much aggrieved.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. The city superintendent of police, the serpent, saw that the citizens were being attacked by Kalakanya, and he became very aggrieved to see his own residence set ablaze after being attacked by the Yavanas. Please repeat. The city superintendent of police,
the, superintendent,
the serpent,
the serpent,
saw that the citizens were being attacked by Kalakanya. And he became
very aggrieved
to see his own residence
set ablaze
after being attacked by the Yavanas. Purport. The living entity is covered by two different types of bodies, the gross body and the subtle body. At death, we can see that the gross body is finished. But actually, the living entity is carried by this subtle body to another gross body. The so-called scientists of the modern age cannot see how this subtle body is working in carrying the soul from one body to another. This subtle body has been figuratively described as a serpent, or the city's police superintendent. When there is fire everywhere, the police superintendent cannot escape either. When there is security and an absence of fire in the city, the police superintendent can impose his authority upon the citizens, but when there is an all-out attack on the city, he is rendered useless. As the life air was ready to leave the gross body, the subtle body also began to experience pain. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Vakale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swamiji Namaste Saraswati Devi Gaura Vani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pasha Jade Shitarane Mukam Kiroti Vachalam Pangam Langayate Girim Yad Kripa Tamaham Vande Shri Gurum Dinataranam. By the mercy of the spiritual master, a dumb man can recite eloquent poetry, and a lame man can cross mountains. So all of you present here today are in different ways my spiritual masters. So I ask you to bless me that this dumb and lame person can speak something which will be inspiring to you and which will please the Lord. Hare Krishna. So here in this chapter 28, we're coming to the end of what's quite a long section of Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 4, the story of Paranjana. He's coming to, in fact, his bitter end, as he's very painfully and miserably being forced out of his gross body. So for those of you who aren't regularly present in the Bhagavatam class, I'll give a little background on this history. So this is actually an allegorical story. An allegory is a story where there are the characters within the story are like symbols which represent another thing. So this story is full of kind of metaphors. And at the end of chapter 28, there's a whole glossary that explains, or Srila Prabhupada explains what each thing symbolizes. That's interesting. It's quite complex. I won't get too much into the symbols, but I'll tell you the story and emphasize one certain aspect of it. Okay, so Narada Muni told this story to King Prachinabharhishat. Prachinabharhishat was a materialistic person who was engaged in fruitive activities. He performed many animal sacrifices, of course, where animals were killed, and he didn't have much interest in spiritual life. On the other hand, his sons, the Prachetas, are glorified because in order to fulfill their purpose in life, they went to perform devotional service for many thousands of years to please the Lord in order to become empowered to do the service that was bestowed upon them. So Narada Muni took compassion on King Prachinibarhisha, and he told the story of Paranjana. So Paranjana, the story of Paranjana, Paranjana is, in one sense, he's not a real person. He's kind of a fictitious character. But it's just like sometimes parents, in order to instruct children, we want to say, you know, say you have a daughter who is, you know, selfish. So then instead of saying, you know, you need to change, you're selfish, it's no good, you're going to suffer a lot in the future because of this if you don't change now, then the parent may say, tell a story, right? That once upon a time, there was a little girl who was very selfish. And then this happened to her, and this happened to her, and she didn't have friends, and her life was, you know, very difficult because she had this selfishness. So in that way, it's addressing the problem, and a child who is intelligent will learn from that story without feeling that she's being personally attacked, right? Without feeling hurt, but that she'll think, oh, yeah, I shouldn't be selfish then. So in the same way, Prachinibarhisha was a king, he's a kshatriya, and kshatriyas are not known for their humility, usually, especially materialistic ones. So Narada Muni very expertly told this story in order to instruct Prachinibarhisha. But in another sense, Paranjana, the story of Paranjana applies to all of us, right? Just like Krishna instructed Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, but through that instruction, he's instructing the whole world. So in the same way, Narada Muni is instructing all of us through the story of Paranjana. Because Paranjana, Puram means within the body, and Jana means the living entity. So we are all living entities within bodies. So Paranjana means us as well. So we should take this instruction to heart, that what happened to King Paranjana could happen to any one of us if we're not careful. Okay, so it all starts off with Paranjana wandering around in a beautiful place, and he happens to meet a beautiful young woman there. So he immediately becomes infatuated by her beauty, and he approaches her. Right? Kshatriyas are also not known for their shyness. So he very boldly went up to her, flattered her, spoke some sweet words to her, and in the same conversation basically proposed to her. So she accepted. And from that time on, the two of them were inseparable. Right? It's described in chapter 26 how when the queen ate, the king would eat. When the queen would sit down, the king would sit down. When the queen would go for a walk, the king would go for a walk. When the queen would laugh, the king would laugh. So it was like they were kind of a one personality in two bodies. They were Paranjana and Paranjani. So, yeah. But one day, Paranjana, he was a kshatriya, and kshatriyas like to hunt. They're allowed to hunt. So he was overcome by this desire to go out hunting. And without asking permission from his queen, or even informing her where he was going, he just got his bow and his quiver, mounted his chariot, and set off to the forest to hunt. So during that hunting trip, he was very much overwhelmed by a demonic propensity. And he started just killing animals left, right, and center. Right? He was mercilessly killing practically anything that moved within the forest. And that went on for some time, so much that even people living in the forest became aggrieved to see, you know, how heinously cruel he was. Eventually he became fatigued, he became tired and hungry, and decided to go back, it was time to go back to the palace. So he returned to the palace, took a bath, ate something, and then immediately he went to find out where the queen was. So he was looking and here and there and asking the maid servants, you know, have you seen, you know, my beloved queen? I'm very eager to find her. Then he finally found her, and she was lying on the floor. She was lying on the bare floor with, you know, her clothes all wet with tears, and her hair all scattered, and her eyes red, and she'd been crying for a long time. So he immediately felt repentant that he had abandoned such a devoted wife and just went out and performed, all kinds of sinful, basically, activities there in the forest. So he tries to cheer her up. And the first thing he does is he touches her feet. Then he apologizes to her for leaving her. And he speaks lots of sweet words, flatters her again. And then eventually, of course, first she chastises him a little, like, you know, how could you leave me, and like that. But eventually she becomes favorably disposed towards him again. So what's interesting in this section, the first part of the narration, is Srila Prabhupada's purports to these verses. The part of the story that I've just told you is pretty much the whole of chapter 26. And then in each purport, Srila Prabhupada gives his own metaphors to these verses, which are very, they create a certain mood, which I think is revealing of something. So, first of all, he compares Paranjana's hunting trip to the soul's engagement in sinful activities. Then, when Paranjana returns to the palace, this is Srila Prabhupada compares this to the fallen soul's returning to his original Krishna consciousness. Right, that he becomes, the conditioned soul, after engaging in so many sinful activities, he finally kind of comes to his senses and he thinks, I can't go on with this lifestyle, it's so, you know, nasty. And he begins to search for something higher. So the king's returning to the palace is that, his consciousness pricking him in a sense, or just fatigue of, you know, just too much grossly sinful life. Then, the king searches for the queen. And Srila Prabhupada says that the queen represents Paranjana's intelligence. So, and then in the purport there, Srila Prabhupada says that there's no difference between a good wife and good intelligence. And now I'll read that particular verse here in the Bhagavad Gita, where the king is speaking to his maidservants, asking where the queen is. He says, "Kindly let me know the whereabouts of that beautiful woman who always saves me when I'm drowning in an ocean of danger. By giving me good intelligence at every step, she always saves me." And then here in this purport, Srila Prabhupada speaks about how a real wife is a Dharma Patni, that she's very chaste and faithful to her husband, and she helps him through whatever difficult situations he may face. So then Paranjana feels regret for having abandoned the queen. And Srila Prabhupada compares this to a feeling of repentance for sins. When the conditioned soul, after engaging in so many sinful activities, becomes a little conscious and tries to revive his Krishna consciousness, it's natural that there'll be a deep feeling of remorsefulness or repentance for having, you know, abandoned Krishna and performed all of those sinful activities. So the king's lament, the king's regret, is compared to this. It's compared to lamenting his abandoning Krishna, or abandoning his Krishna consciousness. Then when Paranjana touches the queen's feet, that's compared to the disciples touching the feet of the spiritual master. That this is very essential for spiritual life, to take the dust of the lotus feet of the spiritual master, to humble oneself in the presence of the spiritual master. And then when the queen becomes angry and chastises Paranjana, Paranjana accepts that chastisement as mercy. He accepts it in a good state of mind. He doesn't try to defend himself. So Srila Prabhupada explains that this is the proper way for a disciple to accept chastisement, right? That only a fool becomes, that a fool becomes angry when he's given good instruction, but a good disciple will accept chastisement graciously as the mercy of the guru. So then gradually, through the king's behavior towards her, the queen becomes peaceful again, and she gets up, she goes and takes her bath, and makes herself nice again. And so Srila Prabhupada, then her beauty is restored. So Srila Prabhupada compares the beautiful features of the queen to the beautiful features of Krishna consciousness, right? Because by practicing Krishna consciousness, we gradually develop all the good qualities of the demigods. So Krishna consciousness is very beautiful. Sometimes we can see that devotees who were previously very sinful before, after becoming devotees, they change in every way, even appearance. They completely look different and so much more effulgent and attractive. I'm sure you've all seen that. So Srila Prabhupada compares the queen's beauty to this, the beauty of Krishna consciousness. So then the depiction of the queen in chapter 26 is overall very positive, right? She's described as Paranjana's saving grace, as his good intelligence, as the one who brings him out of the darkness of sinful life. And as we read this chapter, we get a very optimistic feeling that now Paranjana is going to, you know, that he's given up his hunting, he's come home, now he's going to become intelligent and take steps to elevate himself on the path of self-realization. But those of you who know, who've been following this, does Paranjana proceed to elevate himself in the association of his exalted queen? Far from it, right? So what follows in the next chapter is almost an X-rated account of how King Paranjana becomes completely addicted to sex life. Of course, he's religious about it, right? He worships the demigods, he performs animal sacrifices and all these karmakanda activities just to keep enough pious credit so that to keep his sense gratification going. But his motivation is strictly sense gratification and on the grossest level. And not only does he, is his life centered around his own sex life, but he also arranges for the sex life of his 1,210 children by getting them all married to make sure that they can perfect their lives through, you know, engagement in gross sense gratification. So anyways, this was Satya Yuga. So it was possible for one wife to have over 1,000 children, I guess. So Paranjana went on like that. And as they say, time flies when you're having fun. So gradually, time personified, Chand Vega, took its toll. And Paranjana's youth slipped away without his even realizing it. Before he knew it, he was an old man. And his 1,210 children and all their thousands of grandchildren took to plundering his wealth, right? As children are always asking their parents for money. So this was happening on a large scale. That although Paranjana was a king and he had a big treasury, but he had so many children and grandchildren that it wasn't long before, you know, he was basically reduced to poverty. And not only was his wealth plundered, but his body was plundered. Right, old age and invalidity also took away his bodily strength, and his senses became out of order. So in this way, King Paranjana, in great fear and anxiety, was the soul and subtle body were forced out of the body, as we're described here in text 13. And then at that time, I'm jumping ahead a little, but I'll only briefly do so. At that time, when the soul and the subtle body were out of the gross body, all of the animals that he killed and all of his karmakanda sacrifices came before him and started to pierce him with their horns, so much so that he felt like he was being cut to pieces by so many different axes. So Paranjana suffered immensely at the time of death. And then because he had been thinking of his beloved queen, of course, at the time of his death, he was forced to become a woman in the next life. So what I'd like to draw your attention to at this point is how the depiction of the queen in chapter 6 is very different from how the queen is depicted in chapter 27. In fact, it's a stark contrast. It's almost like a pendulum swing from one extreme to the other. Where, as we said before, that in chapter 26 she's described as his saving grace, his good intelligence. And then now in chapter 27, when Paranjana is just completely involved in sex life and sense gratification of all sorts, the queen is said to be the cause of his downfall and the one who bewilders him and drags him into a decadent life, a completely hedonistic life of sense gratification. And then in chapter 27, those same beautiful features, which were previously described to be the beautiful, compared to the beautiful features of Krishna consciousness, those same beautiful features are now the complete representation of Maya. So it's very different. So then as I was reading through these chapters in preparation for the class, I was pondering over this contrast. How is it that on the one hand, she seems to be such a positive influence in his life? And then, but what actually happens is that she becomes a very negative and destructive influence on his life. So then what went wrong? It's important for us to understand what went wrong with Paranjana so that we can avoid going down the same wrong path that he went. Because remember, we are also Paranjanas and Paranjanis. We're all in material bodies and we all have senses which tend to drag us here and there. So some would say that it's the woman's fault, right? She was too beautiful. And Chanika Pandit says, right, that a beautiful wife is actually the enemy to the husband. But then Srila Prabhupada says in a purport of chapter 27, text 2, that it's the wife's duty to always keep herself clean and nicely dressed and attractive, and that that inspires the husband to perform his duties. So the wife should be beautiful. That's her nature, right? Women were designed to be beautiful. And Draupadi was also beautiful. But the Pandavas weren't dragged down into a hedonistic life because they had such a beautiful wife as Draupadi. So then who is the real enemy of the king? What was the real cause of his downfall? But Krishna answers this question in Bhagavad Gita 3:37, where he says, Kama Esha, Krodha Esha, Raja Guna, Samud Bhavaha, Mahashano, Mahashano means all devouring, Mahapapma, greatly sinful, Vidyenam Iha Varhinam, Varhinam means enemy. So here Krishna identifies the real enemy, which is all of our enemy. He says, it is lust only, Arjuna, which is born of contact with the material mode of passion and later transformed into wrath, which is the all-devouring, sinful enemy of this world. So in this way, we should understand very clearly that it was not the beautiful queen that was Paranjana's enemy, but it was his own lust. It was his own contaminated consciousness. Because Paranjana, the situation could have gone either way. The queen was very much attached to him. She was devoted to him. See how she was, you know, crying miserably because he had gone away and not said anything to her. And so when Paranjana came back, he could have easily said, oh, I'm very sorry, and, you know, in the same way cheered her up. But then in the end said, you know, go take your bath, prepare the arti tray, let's worship the Lord together. We can study the shastras, share our realizations. And this way they could have intimate association, but on a level of Krishna consciousness. But no, actually what he said was, I'll read what he said here. So this is the last verse of chapter 26. He says, my dear queen, due to my sinful desires, I went to the forest to hunt without asking you. Therefore, I must admit that I have offended you. Nonetheless, thinking of me as your most intimate subordinate, you should still be very much pleased with me. Factually, I am very much bereaved. But, being pierced by the arrow of Cupid, I am feeling very lusty. Where is the beautiful woman who would give up her lusty husband and refuse to unite with him? So, this was Paranjana's mistake, that instead of seeing his wife as the eternal servant of Krishna, and that it's his duty to engage her in religious activities, he saw her as a sex object, and he engaged her in giving him sensual pleasure. So, thus, due to his own contaminated consciousness, he ended up in the dark well of ignorance, and he dragged her down with him. So this is very, I thought this was very instructive for us, in that it shows how everything depends on our consciousness, right? If we do things for the pleasure of Krishna, try to connect everything in our lives to Krishna's service, in devotional service, then we'll be elevated. But if we see everything and everybody around us as instruments to increase our own personal sense gratification, then like Paranjana, we'll become degraded. So the problem is, the difficulty is, that we've been in the material world for countless lifetimes, at least speak for myself, and maybe many of us, that we've been in here for, since time, we've been here in the material world for, since time immemorial. And so we've become habituated to sense gratification. In different bodies, our activities have just basically been eating, sleeping, mating, defending, sense gratification. Our desire to enjoy separately from Krishna, which is what lust is, the desire to enjoy separately from Krishna, is the whole reason that we're here in the material world. So Krishna makes this very clear in Bhagavad Gita 7:27, where he says, Icha Dvesha Samutena. He says that all living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by the dualities of desire and hate. Icha, desire, the desire to be the supreme enjoyer. And Dvesha, hate. Our hatred is envy of Krishna, who is the actual supreme enjoyer. So, in this way, we've cultivated this mood of sense gratification for millions and millions of lifetimes. And our whole being, our mind, intelligence, and senses are controlled by lust. So the function of the mind is to accept and reject. But when the mind has been habituated to sense gratification, then anything that's good for our sense gratification, we'll accept. But as soon as something is seems to be not so nice for our sense gratification, we'll reject it. That's why, you know, when we start to take to Krishna consciousness seriously, our minds tend to rebel, right? We didn't know that we had the mental disturbances until we became devotees. I mean, at least I did. I was so mental when I first became a devotee. And so it's like when we start to practice Krishna consciousness seriously, then it's like an alarm goes off with the mind. It's like, wee-oh, wee-oh, wee-oh. Sense gratification is being threatened. Prepare to defend, right? And then the intelligence is immediately engaged in finding very good reasons, very intelligent reasons to, for instance, not go to the temple, to not chant, right? It's like when we're supposed to be chanting our rounds, the mind comes up with so many reasons why we should be doing another thing now, right? Instead of chanting. So many other more important things to do. I'm sure you could all, we could, if we sat down and did an exercise to write up all the different excuses our minds gave us for not chanting or not going to the temple, we could put them all together and have a nice long list. So, yeah, we shouldn't listen to our minds. Our minds are not our friends, unfortunately, at least in the beginning. So, yeah, and excuses for so many things, right? For eating boga, the mind will come up with many, oh, you have to eat, you know, karmi biscuits because, you know, there's no time to cook and whatever, the kids like them. Or for wearing non-devotional clothes, reading the newspaper or whatever. Even offending devotees, the mind can come up, well, it's okay to call a spade, Prabhu, right? We have to be honest. So the mind can come up with so many justifications for practically anything which seems to be a threat to our sense gratification. The irony in this is that the materialistic mind thinks that Krishna consciousness is dangerous. Actually, it's sense gratification that's dangerous, right? Because we see that how Paranjana became completely degraded and his life turned out to be miserable because of sense gratification. So this is Maya. Maya means illusion, or that which is not. Right, we're taking that which is going to help us to be dangerous, and that which is very dangerous to be pleasure or to be, you know, what's good for us. So, yes, Krishna consciousness is basically the process of controlling the mind, making our minds our friends, so that we'll accept and reject on the basis of what's good for our Krishna consciousness. And any situation can go either way. It can be an impetus for sense gratification, or it can be an impetus to be Krishna conscious. It's just like, for example, parents with small children, right? You can either say, oh, you know, I'd really like to go to the temple, but, you know, my children are small and they may not behave properly, or, you know, they always have to have some need which is difficult to attend to at the temple, and so that's why I don't go. Or, you know, I know many, not many, but I've spoken to a few mothers who have told me that, you know, since my children were born, I've stopped chanting my rounds. So it's like you can use anything as an excuse to not be Krishna, is a reason to not be Krishna conscious, to not follow strictly. But at the same time, a person whose consciousness is very good and who is determined can use anything as a reason to be Krishna conscious, right? It's just like if you have small children, then all the more reason to go to the temple and take them with you, right? So that they get in the habit of going to the temple, of seeing the deity, that becomes part of their lifestyle. All the more reason to chant our rounds nicely, so that you're setting a good role model for them to follow, so that when they get to be a little older, they can begin to chant. And also to maintain our good consciousness, right? Because who wants a mother who's in Maya? So we also have to do that to set a good example, and also to maintain our consciousness so that we can guide them, because that's our responsibility to guide them in spiritual life. So we have examples. It's like anything, person or situation in life, we should try to use in Krishna's service, use for Krishna's pleasure, somehow or other connect it to Krishna. It's just like a couple of weeks ago I went to one of my younger daughter's friend's birthday party, and the little girl, we gave her a present. It was a little bee that my daughter had made, and as soon as she saw it, she was like, "Oh, Krishna's bumblebee!" And she went and put it on her altar at Krishna's feet. And then another friend came in and gave her a present, and she opened it with some jewelry. And she's like, "Oh, this is so nice for Radharani," and she gave it to her Radharani on the altar. Then another, I was sitting there watching, then another little girl came in with a drawing that she had made, and it was one of these typical drawings with the sky and clouds and a sun and trees and flowers and whatever. And she's like, "Oh, this will be a beautiful background for my small Radha and Krishna," and she put it behind her small Radha and Krishna as a background. So I thought that's amazing. You know, she's been so well trained to accept everything, not for her own self and her own sense gratification, but for Krishna, that she engages everything in Krishna's service. So this is one of the principles of surrender. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about, he lists six principles of surrender, and this is two of them: accepting those things favorable for our devotional service and rejecting those things which are unfavorable. And when we do this, Krishna becomes pleased by our attitude of surrender, and he helps. He says in Bhagavad Gita 7:14, "Daivihye shaguna mayi mama maya duratyaya mam eva ye prapadyante mayam evan etam tarantite." That this energy, this divine energy of mine, consisting of the three modes, is very difficult to overcome, but one who is surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. So through this surrendering, that maybe we want to accept something for our sense gratification, but we're thinking, "No, I have to give it to Krishna. Anyways, it's all his." Then by that surrender, Krishna helps us to transcend the three modes of material nature. So this surrender can take place in a moment, or it can take many lifetimes, right? Bahunam janmanam ante gyanavam mam prapadyate. After many, many millions of births, one may surrender to Krishna. So why is it difficult sometimes? It's because we're in Maya's kingdom, right? This is Maya's place. And Maya is basically the default setting, right? It's like on my computer at home, when I start up the computer, we have two different operating systems, Microsoft and Ubuntu. So when it starts up, then if I don't... Now it's changed. But before, it used to automatically go to Ubuntu. And I don't know how to use Ubuntu, so that's a problem for me. So I have to stay watching it very vigilantly, because the screen flashes for 10 seconds, and if I don't immediately scroll down to Microsoft, it goes to Ubuntu. Right? So it's like that if we don't make the effort, if we're not vigilant and make a constant effort to be Krishna conscious, automatically it's going to go to Maya. Maya just comes right in full force. Or we can also compare it to a flowing river. That if we're in a river and the river is flowing, it's very easy to just lie back, float on your back, and go downstream, right? But to go upstream, it requires some endeavor. You've got to really work. You've got to swim. So in the material world, the downward flow is Maya. So Maya it's really easy to be in Maya. Just go with the flow, right? Like Paranjana did. But if we want to be Krishna conscious, we've got to struggle. We've got to make an effort. And it's not so easy, because Maya is tricky, right? Maya feels good, right? Sense gratification feels good. for most people at least. It's like one student in my class asked me one day, Manaji, my mother's always telling me that I shouldn't listen to Karmi music. But I like it. It makes me happy. I feel so good when I listen to it. So I don't understand why the devotees are always going on about how there's no pleasure in the material world. Because I'm feeling pleasure when I listen to that Karmi music. So, in fact, it's true. There is pleasure in the material world, but it's so tiny, right? It's just a tiny drop compared to the oceanic pleasure of spiritual life. And that material pleasure is very temporary, right? It's ephemeral. It just exists for a very short time and is gone, right? We can use the word evanescent to describe sense pleasure in the material world. Evanescent means that it just vanishes into a vapor, like that one little drop of sense pleasure. As soon as we get it in the palm of our hand, it just immediately evaporates into a vapor and it's gone. And it keeps us wanting more and more, so that our lives become like a desperate endeavor to try to get more and more sense pleasure. But although it's like nectar in the beginning, as we see in the case of Paranjana, it's like poison in the end, because he suffered so miserably in the end. Therefore, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 5:22, Yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate adyanta vantakonteya nateshu ramate buddhaha. So he advises Arjuna that an intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery which are due to contact with the material senses. The sense gratification is the source of misery. He says such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and so the wise man does not delight in them. So we might think, what's wrong with a little sense gratification? I mean, let's not be fanatics, right? But actually, there's no such thing as a little sense gratification, because sense gratification tends to build, right? Has a snowball effect. And Krishna explains this in Bhagavad Gita 3:39, where he says, Avritam jnana etena jnanino nitya varina. There's that word again, varina, the enemy, our eternal enemy. Kama rupena konteya dushparena nalena cha. That the wise living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of lust, which is never satisfied and which burns like fire. So generally, like a religious man, if he's lusty and he's afflicted, he's agitated by sex desire, then he'll get married according to religious principles and he'll restrict himself to one wife. So that's okay, right? That's allowable. Marriage is a license for sense gratification to a certain extent. So, but we have to remember that the materialistic mind tends to reject restrictions, because restrictions are not good for sense gratification. So then, as society, as civilization so-called advances, is advancing in sense gratification, and the minds, it's like the collective minds of everyone in society, are collectively rejecting restrictions in such a way that nowadays, you know, people, they basically reject the whole institution of marriage. You know, they say, why bother about a piece of paper? And we love each other, we're mutually committed to each other, that's enough. So don't bother getting married, you know, it's a waste of money, you gotta pay the whatever, the court fees and things. So then, finish with marriage. And then, well, why only one partner? I mean, that's so limiting. Why not have many different partners? Why not enjoy a diversity of relationships? Because after all, variety is the spice of life. And then, another stage further, why only women, right? Why not men? So then, you know, we've got homosexuals, bisexuals, transsexuals. They're basically ready to, you know, try. And it's an open field. And then why only adults? Let's try children, animals, even dead bodies, right? There's the word necrophilia. Like we have pedophiles, there are necrophiles. So there's all sorts. It's completely degraded. And in this way, it just sort of spirals down. In modern day society now, people would consider Paranjana to be a saint, practically, right? At least he only had one wife. So we're living in the perverted, this is a perverted reflection, and it's getting more and more perverted as time goes by. It's our lust that got us here, and it's our lust that keeps us here. So we need to make the endeavor to purify ourselves of contaminated consciousness, to free ourselves of our lust. So we can't blame anybody else. We can't say, you know, that it was the way she smiled at me, or it was, you know, his deep, that deep, strong voice, his profound words, right? Or it was that chocolate cake in the bakery window that was the cause of my fall down, right? We can't blame anything external, because just like Paranjana, you know, it appears to be that his wife dragged him down, but it was his own lust that drags him down. Because, you know, a person who's not lusty will see the chocolate cake in the window and not be fazed by it. Just be like, oh, nice cake, right? But it doesn't create this intense yearning, right, in your heart that you have to have it, which is a symptom of lust. So, yeah, as we take to Krishna consciousness, then gradually it's a process of, as I said, retraining the mind, putting the mind in its place. So we have to be determined and vigilant, and to always make the endeavor, right? To not be pulled down the river in Maya's flow. By following the orders of the spiritual master strictly, we can train our minds so that instead of accepting everything for sense gratification, they'll accept everything in the spirit of using it, dovetailing it in Krishna's service. And then, after we become, our minds have become our friend and our intelligence has become fixed on the goal of Krishna consciousness, then when lust rears its ugly head, as it will, even in a very advanced devotee, the alarm will go off again that, wee-oo, 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 right? My consciousness is under attack. Take shelter of Krishna. Right? It's a totally different scenario all of a sudden, because the consciousness is different. So we have to take shelter of devotees, take shelter of Srila Prabhupada's books, of the holy name, because Lord Chaitanya says, Krishna Surya Sama Maya Haya Andhakara Yahan Krishna Tahan Nahi Mayara Adhikara. Krishna is like the sun and Maya is like darkness. Wherever there is Krishna, there cannot be the darkness of Maya. And in the preface of the Nectar of Devotion, Srila Prabhupada says that he says that devotional service is like the one switch, that when you flip that switch, it turns on all the lights and it brightens everything, everywhere. So when the lights are on, we can see actually where the real enjoyment is, because the real enjoyment is not in sense gratification, right? It's just an ephemeral, evanescent drop compared to the ocean of transcendental bliss. Because Krishna is a reservoir of pleasure, so as soon as we connect ourselves to that reservoir, we're going to feel a kind of enjoyment which is so much higher. It's like unlimitedly higher. And whereas that drop immediately disappears, the transcendental pleasure of Krishna consciousness doesn't disappear. It stays eternally and it's ever increasing. So, yeah, we have to take to this path of illumination. And therefore Krishna has glorified the process of devotional service in Bhagavad Gita 9.2. He says, Raja Vidya Raja Guyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyaksha Vagamam Daryam Susukam Kartam Avyayam. This knowledge is the king of education, the most secret of all secrets. It is the purest knowledge, and because it gives direct perception of the self by realization, it's the perfection of religion. It is everlasting, and it is joyfully performed. So, Bhagavad Gita. So Bhagavad Gita is the song of God. Bhagavad Gita is meant to be sung. And our lives are meant for serving Krishna. But if we misuse our lives, if we misuse our independence and live our lives for sense gratification, then we'll come to the same bitter end as Paranjana. But on the other hand, if we devote our lives to serving Krishna with faith and devotion, we'll be everlastingly joyful. Jai Krishna. Are there any questions or comments, corrections?
There are many ways that we can enjoy sense gratification in Krishna consciousness. Myself, I like contemporary music also, so I listen to Krishna Prema every day. You know, it's on my computer and I just plug it in. So many nice chants, so many nice songs. And so they all have a contemporary melody, you know, a little different. Each one is a little different. So those opportunities are there. And then, of course, people make smoothies and they make luscious prasadam and so forth. All these opportunities are there. So sometimes, though, devotees feel like this is too much, you know, that this is not the right thing. You know, in fact, sometimes devotees take on an attitude that you should be more austere. You know, they're suffering through some austerity which is beyond the call, beyond the necessity. And then they think other people should be more austere. How do you deal with that in your own mind and in instructing those persons who are insisting on a standard that's beyond comprehension?
So Krishna consciousness, the way that Srila Prabhupada has delivered it to us, is not a process of self-abnegation, right? That don't do this and don't do that and don't do this and don't do that. But it's do everything for Krishna. So it's like you said, there's no harm in listening to Krishna conscious music in a contemporary style. I have heard though that you know, that listening, say, you know, sometimes devotees put Krishna conscious philosophy in a song to like a rock and roll beat or a rap or something like that. I have heard devotees say that it can be degrading. It can be degrading in that it may remind you of, you know, before you became a devotee, when you used to listen to that style of music, and it will bring back those memories and impressions of all the other things you used to do when you used to listen to that kind of music. Right? In the same way that there's some devotees that started drinking non-alcoholic beer, right? So it tastes like beer, so they think that it's kind of like, but it's non-alcoholic, so in that sense, if they're not breaking the regulative principles. But the problem with that is that when they drink that, the whole scene comes back to them, you know, beer and parties and relaxing and, you know, loose associations with the opposite sex, and the whole thing sort of, you know, comes into their consciousness. So if we can listen to that music, that kind of music, and not be haunted by these memories of, you know, what that music used to mean to us, at least that, you know, mode of sound vibration, then it's fine. But I would say that if that does happen, then we have to be careful with it. And that it is a higher principle. I think it is a higher standard to listen to traditional bhajans, you know, like Srila Prabhupada's bhajans and things like that. But those are very useful for somebody who really likes that kind of music and can't give it up. And if it's a question of, you know, being a devotee or listening to that music, then let them be a devotee and listen to the music. See what I mean? So I think it's an individual thing, and we have to see how it affects the person's mind. Because on the one hand, for a person who's very attached to materialistic enjoyment and is really into that music and won't become a devotee if they can't listen to it, then it's good, because that music is bringing them to Krishna. It's helping them to stay in the association devotees. But if someone's already a devotee and they've been practicing Krishna consciousness for years, and then they start listening to that music and it brings up memories of sense gratification and tends to bring them, you know, into a sort of a contaminated, nostalgic state, then I'd say it's not good. So it's an individual thing.
Well, okay? Any kind of sense gratification can bring us into a distraction, you know, either from the past, or if you're a young devotee, you've never been exposed to these things, they can, you know, careful to try to how do you say, keep the mind on a short leash.
Yeah.
so that it doesn't wander too far.
It's very important to continually read the scriptures, because in the scriptures, because in one sense, the red sports car, everything in the material world, from the beautiful woman to the red sports car to the rock and roll music, it's all Krishna's energy. So the more we read the scriptures and understand that, everything is Krishna's energy. There's para prakriti and there's apara prakriti. So the para prakriti is, the material world, the gross elements of the material world. So when we see that, we can see that that's also Krishna, and that should be used for Krishna. That this is Krishna's, all of this is Krishna's energy, and it has no other purpose. That my life, my body, my home, my mind, everything has no other purpose except to give Krishna pleasure. Then we read in Bhagavad Gita that Krishna says, I'm the taste of water, I'm the light of the sun and the moon, I'm the strength of the strong, the intelligence of the intelligent. And so anything that we see, we can try to make an effort to cultivate this ability to see the world through the eyes of the scripture, say, Shastra Chakshu. And that will help us to not be distracted, because then when we become advanced in that vision of the world, it won't be a distraction, because we won't see it as sense gratification. We'll just see it as a manifestation of Krishna's energy. But that takes some practice. It doesn't happen, immediately.
It's an interesting point, actually. I remember when I was here in 1976, they had Chennai band on the gate. Mm-hmm. And every morning we hear that music is played again. I don't think it was copyrighted. I think it was stolen. But Prabhupada was asked, by some of the older devotees, this is sense gratification, Prabhupada. This is not good. This music is so attractive, because they had been jazz musicians, and it was very, in that line. And Prabhupada said, no, it's very nice. It's classical. So even though it's even instrumental, there's no chanting in it or anything like that, it creates an atmosphere that's favorable to devotional service. So similarly, someone having cushions in his home or something like that, that can be considered, well, that's very heavy sense gratification. But it just depends on how serious we are about Krishna consciousness. As you said, it's our business to give our minds to Krishna and not worry so much about these external things, not be overwhelmed by them. At the same time, not try to abnegate them to such an extent that we're very uncomfortable, and that leads also to a fall down.
Yeah, it comes back to the same principle of surrender, that to accept whatever's favorable for our Krishna consciousness. And then what for one person, what's favorable, just like one man's food is another's poison, right? So what's favorable for one person's Krishna consciousness may be unfavorable for another person. So we have to be honest and always, be conscious of things and situations in our lives and make sure that we accept everything in that spirit, accept what's favorable and reject what's unfavorable.
So how do we deal with people? How do we deal with people who want to enforce a strictness or their own level of Krishna consciousness on others? How do you deal with those people?
Tolerate them. What else? They can say, "Leave me alone." No, I mean, just leave them. Some people are like that. They'll always be fanatics, and they'll always be balanced people, and they'll always be people who are kind of like, going the other way. That's just life. There's all kinds of people and different standards. But we have to, be true to ourselves and, not try to do something pretentious just to impress somebody else or accept something which is not favorable just because somebody's pressurizing us to do so. I said, if someone's pressuring you to accept a standard of austerity that you just can't handle, then it's not good for you, right? We have to be moderate. And Krishna says we should be balanced in our activities, eating, sleeping, resting, and work and recreation. So we need to find each individual has their own balance, and we have to, we have to know what our balance is and keep it in balance. And, we're all flying our own ship, and we all have a different psychophysical nature. We have different, our minds work differently, and we need to just, we're individuals.
That's a very nice answer. And it's up to us, actually, to assert ourselves to a certain extent, to follow instructions, but also to assert ourselves and not be overwhelmed by others.
Yes, we're not impersonal. This is not an impersonal movement that everybody's going to do one thing. And, it's unity and diversity. So it takes all types. It takes fanatics as well. They have their place. Right?
That's true.
They keep us honest.
Thank you very much for a wonderful class.
I'll have to stop here. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam.